This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Police, fire, even City Hall, they're just like us when it comes to social media. They are looking for ways to get your attention.
Well, this is how I think of it. When you're scrolling through, would you stop by or not? And if I say not, then you probably need to do something that's going to catch somebody's attention.
Bloomington Police Officer John Furman is putting his marketing degree from ISU to work as the department's public information officer. Plus, the Juvenile Justice Coordinating Council has been focusing on mental health among teens in the Twin Cities. It's adding an emphasis on gun violence, Ryan Denham reports. And State Senator Jason Berrickman tells us now that the budget is done, what's next? Could it be pensions? All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Social media has become such a dominant force in much of our lives that it's become nearly impossible to avoid. We use it to reconnect with friends, make new ones, buy and sell products, and yes, sometimes wage political debates. And as GLT's Eric Stock explains, those who mind our tax dollars are also getting into the social media space. More and more, like the rest of us, they are learning as they go.
When Matt Sweeney heard that a refurbished Normal Fire Department engine caught fire on the interstate in January of last year, he knew this would be his version of a five-alarm blaze. Sweeney is the Normal Fire Department's public information officer. An increasingly big part of that job is managing the department's social media platforms.
Before I could even get back to my desk, there were pictures and video of our fire engine on the side of the road burning up, and it's not something we can hide. You know, it's our fire engine on fire.
If something like this had happened when Sweeney started working for the department in 2010, it's likely few would have even noticed. But in this digital age, where nearly everyone has a camera in their pocket and instant access to the online world, it became an instant social media firestorm. So Sweeney did what any self-respecting social media manager would do. He owned it.
We had to get in front of it, and we put out a post that says, you know, unfortunately the rumors are true. We lost a fire engine this morning to a fire, and while it's ironic and sad, you know, we still had to put the information out because, you know, it's out there anyway. We might as well be a part of the conversation.
The Normal Fire Department's social media platforms include the standards, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and a neighborhood app called Nextdoor. NFT has one of the most active social media accounts among government agencies in McLean County, posting pictures from fire scenes, relaying weather alerts, and putting out your basic safety reminders, such as turning on your headlights when it's raining. That kind of content might be an essential part of what public safety agencies do, but that doesn't generally attract eyeballs, especially in the online world where content blasts like water out of a fire hose. In a medium where snark often rules, you have to say something that gets readers' attention.
Well, I like to claim I'm a funny person.
John Furman is the public information officer for the Bloomington Police Department. He manages the department's social media.
Well, this is how I think of it. When you're scrolling through, would you stop by or not? And if I say not, then you probably need to do something that's going to catch somebody's attention.
A scroll of BPD's Facebook page shows lots of cat memes, funny misadventures, and words of wisdom from Yoda. These are all lighthearted attempts to convey important points, but there's the serious, too. Social media has become a primary way for law enforcement to get the public's help in investigating cases, especially through an app BPD joined late last year called Neighbors. Similar to Nextdoor, police and even people in your neighborhood can post crime alerts and other safety information. Users can even upload video from a home security camera. Furman says when the department posts photos of suspects they're looking for, they often get replies from the public within minutes, sometimes seconds. That can help them make an arrest. West. He says BPD has had 15 to 20 cases where a social media post directly led to an arrest. He suspects apps like Neighbors will help that number grow.
That could technically, or could be, the like ideal spot for like help identifies. People can actually go to that and be like, hey, you know what, I'm sitting in bed, I wonder if I can identify anybody in these cases. And we could probably put more information on those help identifies. Because if we do it a bunch on Facebook, then it's going to become noise.
So how does a public body measure how effective its use of social media is? Nora Dukowitz is communications manager for the city of Bloomington. She says the city is still defining those metrics. But make no mistake, she says social media must do more than satisfy some broad concept of public awareness. The city seeks tangible benefits.
We are not necessarily using this just because, first of all, I'll say just in quotations, just to drive information or just to get information out there. We're using this for business purposes also. You know, we want to sell tickets to the BCPA. We want to get visitors to the zoo. I mean, those are real business models.
The Bloomington Center for the Performing Arts and Miller Park Zoo are just two of the many city-run entities that run their own social media. The city also offers a free My Bloomington app where residents can report things like potholes, public nuisances, and requests for bulk waste pickup. Coming up with a true cost-benefit analysis can be difficult, but seeing what works and what doesn't is easily attainable, especially for someone like Nate Carpenter. He runs the Social Media Analytics and Command Center, or SMAC Lab, at Illinois State University.
If you're an organization like a municipality or emergency management agency, or even somebody in public office, if you're going to reach your constituency, it's hard to compete.
As you might expect, funny rules online. The Town of Normal's most popular post ever is the Great Wild Turkey Crossing, a photoshopped image of wild turkeys crossing Jersey Avenue on April Fool's Day. It's been shared more than 470 times. Carpenter says municipalities use this type of content to get people to follow so they are more likely to see the next traffic alert or boil order.
I think that's what we have come to expect culturally, right? That this really ought to be, a space that gets information out and that's about it. But, there is an expectation, too, that's at least culturally right now, that we be either entertained or that we also share a common culture.
Carpenter says many larger corporations have full-time social media managers or entire staffs that can help build the company's brand and fill much of the vacuum online. That's generally not something a city or a fire department can do, for example. But Carpenter argues too many companies treat it as a side job.
You can't expect to grab an intern from your local university or community college and assume that person's going to be able to maintain everything. You have to get those people training, and I realize budgets are tight, but people who are in the role of managing those social media accounts are going to be seen by more people than are reading your press releases.
Nora Dukowitz with the City of Bloomington says she spends about 25% of her job managing Bloomington's social media, but that's much more than posting content. There's a responding to questions and feedback and monitoring other sites. The challenge, she says, is managing all of that in the confines of a city hall that generally operates on a 9-to-5 philosophy, while some city services, like police and fire, are 24/7. So what should the expectations be?
That's an evolving area. All of our social media accounts do have a disclaimer on them that we aren't monitoring them 24/7. We just don't have the resources to be able to do that. However, we are also aware that some people, that is their most comfortable way of communicating.
And sometimes they're relaying an emergency when they should be calling 911. The Bloomington Police Department's John Furman says that happens about once a week, though not as much as he had feared initially. He says he makes it a point to respond as quickly as he can if it's an emergency.
It'd be terrible if we didn't reply. I mean, it'd be like coming to the police department and knocking on the window and nobody comes out and replies to you. So we try to get to them as soon as we can.
Another element to monitoring social media is responding when the conversation turns nasty or personal. That can easily happen when police departments show someone's mugshot or posts an arrest.
Some of the crime-related posts that we have, there might be 500 comments. I try to look as best as I can. If anybody personally attacks somebody or You know, we've got it's a long page of, you know, what the page rules are, but we also have to look at First Amendment rights.
Furman says the department generally draws the line at vulgarity or threats. Repeat offenders will get blocked, which Furman says has only happened a handful of times. While social media managers constantly have one eye at what people are saying about them online, they also have to keep an eye toward the future. No one knows how long Facebook will be around or what the next big app will be, but they must continue looking for new ways to reach their audience. Matt Swaney with Normal Fire says the department could soon start experimenting with live videos from fire or crash scenes, which some fire departments in major cities are doing.
We don't have 100% on how we're going to manage this yet. It's just something that we're looking at doing, and we've seen other fire departments doing it, and if somebody's doing it right and they're getting good feedback on it, then it's something that we can try and see if it works here.
Swaney says a major obstacle would be protecting someone's medical privacy. For now, though, the Normal Fire Department and Bloomington Police Department view their social media platforms as a public image tool. BPD's John Furman says he hopes social media can break down barriers, just as he tried to do when he started as an officer on the streets.
Most of us are just good people trying to do the best that we can for our community. And that's kind of what we want to show, that angle, because a lot of the times, you know, police officers are portrayed as like the principal at the school or the disciplinarian. Like, nobody wants to talk to the police because you're probably in trouble.
And the Normal Fire Department's Matt Swaney says part of that humanizing approach involves having a little fun at your colleagues' expense.
The cops don't get offended when we made a picture of one of their squad cars with donut wheels, and then they take it and they run pictures of the fire department asleep on recliners. You know, it's the back and forth kind of thing like that. That's just, it's fun. We have a mutual respect for each other, but we can still poke fun at each other too.
And Swaney says photos are better than text online, and videos are better than photos. But what ultimately works online is what tugs at the heartstrings. I'm Eric Stock.
Sometimes social media addresses a controversy. Tomorrow in Sound Ideas, how governments respond when social media creates the controversy.
Support for GLT comes from SEFQ, offering competitive rates for home equity lines of credit. Borrowers get personalized service without the hidden fees or early payoff penalties. Plus, SEFQ even covers closing costs for qualified members. Information at SEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, politics in Illinois. State Senator Jason Berrickman talks about the recent spring session and what's next. For several years, McLean County's Juvenile Justice Council, it's an interagency group, has focused on three priorities: truancy, education, trauma, and job skills. But last summer, a new issue emerged: gun violence. The Juvenile Justice Council responded by creating a working group focused on gun violence. GLT's Ryan Denham talks with the council's current, former and current chair, Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner, and McLean County Court Services Director Cassie Taylor about their work.
Through the conversation at one of our meetings, there was some discussion about the gun violence that was going on last year, and how we saw an increased number in young people that were involved in those, but also individuals that were adults that were involved, but also probably had some history in that wasn't the first time they'd had some run-ins, and that they had also had some involvement when they were juveniles. And so we thought it seemed to be reasonable to put together another look at this and see if there was an opportunity to make some improvements there. And so what we did was we formed a work group. The work group has met one time since then, and we are looking at how we can identify some areas that we may pass forward, if you will, in the areas of intervention, prevention, and suppression and as it relates to gun violence.
So who's part of the work group?
Well, that would be myself, Chief Bleichner, Don Knapp, our state's attorney, Carla Barnes, the public defender, and at the time we had Camille Rodriguez, who was the director of public health, but she has now moved on to another position as county administrator. And so that work group will be putting together ideas or a proposal, if you will, to promote those action steps, and we'll introduce those to the full council at our next meeting.
And so I realize this proposal is probably still being shaped, mm-hmm. very much so. But even in broad strokes, what are some possible action steps that could be part mm-hmm. of it, even categories of action mm-hmm. steps, just to help people kind of conceptualize what this could look like?
Well, I do know that in our work group, when we discussed it, the idea that perhaps we need to look at broader ideas than just gun violence, because that might be a smaller subset of the youth that we're dealing with. And so one of the ideas that we were presenting was that we need to look at violence as a whole for youth, and also include issues such as domestic violence in the home, violence to caregivers. And so I think that might be the direction that when we look at those issues of prevention and intervention, that we just don't limit ourselves to one type of violence for youth, but also directed in several areas that need improvement.
And we also looked is because when we previously had done our delinquency prevention plan, we had also reached out for some opportunities through our local partners, whether it be Illinois State or Illinois Wesleyan, in looking at some assistance with marketing and helping with that. And so there might be an opportunity there along the way to share a message, whether it's prevention of violence or whether it's something else we identify or gun violence itself. There may be a way in which to do that. And so that's another area in which we're looking at that. Plus, we're trying to, as part of the Juvenile Justice Council, I mean, it's having a lot of people around the table that have different ideas and different thoughts and different outreach, if you will, and looking for their input in how we may do that as far as an education campaign is certainly going to be critical. So again, in broad strokes, those are some of the ideas. We don't want to certainly get ahead of the full council and what their thoughts are, but those are just some recommendations that we'll be bringing to them at the next meeting.
So downstate communities like Champaign, Urbana, and Peoria have these kind of community-wide formalized programs, what's called focused deterrence for our listeners. Peoria's is called Don't Shoot. Champaign's is called Fresh Start. What do you think of those programs? Do they work? And do you see the need for something like that here as it relates to the gun violence issue and the work you're doing on the juvenile side?
From my standpoint, I mean, I think those communities chose those programs for very specific purposes, and certainly they think it's the right fit for them. I can tell you that both of those communities have reached out to myself and Bloomington, and I'm sure they probably reach out to others, because when they look at the as we have noticed, obviously, we saw a spike in some gun violence in 2018. And as much as we thought that was a concern for us, other communities were looking at it because they had far more serious problems. And so I would say that those programs certainly were great for those communities. We have to look at what fits best for Bloomington Normal. And I think our approach that law enforcement has taken, that the courts have taken, and that other partners have taken seems to be the right one. I mean, we're not sitting back and doing nothing in these cases. We're collaborating and we're talking about this. And again, a lot of those communities reach out to us and say, hey, what are you doing? And so I think in those cases, we do have some programs. We have this collaborative effort moving forward. Because we don't have a tagline or a name for it, certainly doesn't mean that we aren't focusing on these areas and making them a priority throughout our agencies and then collectively.
Yeah, and those programs are not a magic pill. If Peoria has Don't Shoot, they've had Don't Shoot. They still have no shortage of gun homicides on an annual basis. And the question of gun violence is interesting, and I think it speaks to what you've said about broadening it beyond just gun violence to other types of youth-involved violence. What is your view of how forcefully to respond on this gun violence thing? Because, yes, we had 9 deaths in 1 year. You know, that could have been an outlier, and should we treat it as an outlier, or is it something that's at risk of reoccurring?
I certainly don't think whenever we see a spike in something, we don't look at it as an outlier, because we know that it ebbs and flows, and if you're not on top of whatever type of crime pattern you see, then it's going to be you're going to be at the whim of whether it's going to continue or not, and that's in the hands of the individuals who choose to perpetrate that crime. So our approach, along with other law enforcement agencies, is just to be as proactive as possible. I mean, when we look at that, we certainly share resources. We share information at a local level, at a state and a federal level, which is helpful. We also monitor our crime statistics on not just annual, not just monthly, sometimes weekly, and in some cases daily, to see where we have spikes. And because we're fortunate enough, again, kind of going back to the comparisons in our communities, that you know, in a place like Springfield, Peoria, or, you know, some of those other larger cities, a spike in a certain crime of 4 or 5 may not mean anything to them. Where here, we have the ability to look at that, and on a, you know, a daily basis or on a weekly basis, we may notice that, you know what, we've got an increase in vehicle burglaries. And in the course of those vehicle burglaries, guess what? We've had, you know, 3 weapons that were actually taken in those. We can catch it at a much smaller granular level and then be able to deploy our resources and react to that. So I think that is our approach. And again, I wouldn't consider 9 homicides or 1 homicide an outlier. I think we look at those and we look at the circumstances surrounding those and how can we gather the information we need to combat those in the future. And I think that's just a very proactive response we take to all crime problems.
What are the other kind of most urgent priorities in front of the Juvenile Justice Council? When you all get together at this point, what is sort of dominating the conversation?
The 2 things that seem to be dominating our conversations at our meetings would be our truancy review board and the Youth Build jobs program and also the Project Oz jobs program. And so I think Chief Bleichner said it very well that the police have that response to crime and they try to be proactive. I think with court services and some of the other service agencies that are at the table for the Juvenile Justice Council, our idea is to look at, analyze what behaviors brought them into contact with the juvenile justice system and what needs are lacking. And so the 2 things that we've seen with that are getting them back into school, having a connection to school, having a connection to the community is important. And so the Truancy Review Board has been making great efforts and had some successes with that in getting youth, even younger youth than you would expect, to get back in school and addressing that family component or whatever those barriers might be to having them in school. And likewise, the Youth Build Summer Jobs Program has been excellent at making connections with youth and having peer referrals as well as, you know, probation referrals and other community agency referrals to their jobs program. And I know Project Oz jobs program is successful at well at recruiting youth into those programs so that they can get certifications and learn how to interview, learn how to do a resume, and they're building up those skill sets. And so I believe those programs have been very successful in placing youth in jobs after the summer jobs program. And I know Alicia, when she speaks at it in meetings, she'll say, yeah, well, it'll be the end of the program. And they'll say, I don't want to leave. I want to learn more. I want to get more certifications. I didn't accomplish as much as I wanted this summer. And so that's good to hear, because that's building that need within those youth and within our community to help them succeed and avoid future involvement with the justice system.
Youth who drop out of school or don't go to school are at a severe disadvantage for negative involvement, whether it be with law enforcement or other services. And the same thing with youth that are not engaged, that don't have job skills, that don't have some trade and work opportunities, they're much more likely to get involved with the criminal justice system. And I can tell you that just in looking at the information and the numbers, and Cassie can certainly back me up on this or correct me if I'm wrong, but we see that, you know, a lot of those youth that are involved in the summer jobs program, the engagement or the interaction in a negative way with the criminal justice system drops off drastically. So when they're engaged, when they're given work, when they have that structure that's there, they are much less likely to become involved negatively with the justice system.
In the age of cell phones and Fortnite and everything, where it's hard to get the attention of young people, is it hard to get young people to show up to this stuff and to be willing to engage with these things that are put in front of them when you have a plate full of options to intervene in a kid who's maybe going down a bad path? Is it hard to get them to say yes and to show up for this stuff?
Our experience with the criminal justice system with probation programs is, yes, sometimes it is hard to get them to engage and show up for programs. I think the key is to not have it promoted through probation, to have a peer-supported or a peer recruitment process where they can relate to the people and ask questions in a way that they wouldn't feel comfortable asking to a probation officer or some other member of the criminal justice system. I think that is key to that. So, you know, don't take my word for it. Go ask your friends how they liked summer jobs program, or go ask this guy who's been through the Youth Build program. Ask him what it was like. Don't ask me. I think that is key to helping get them engaged. And I think once they're engaged, they'll stay in the programs. It's just getting their attention at first.
I mean, in McLean County, it's easy to look and always say we need additional programs, and certainly we can look at those and vet those, but we are relatively fortunate when we compare ourselves to other counties and when you look around. So we do have some opportunities, and really, you know, JJC is really that, is bringing people together and understanding what those opportunities are and then trying to provide them in a way. And then a lot of times, what Cassie mentioned was that, you know, not having that formal connection, whether it be law enforcement or probation or whatever, is helpful, because if you provide that structure and you provide that sense of belonging, a lot of times what we see is, you know, if youth have an engaged person in their life, whether it be mom, dad, aunt, uncle, grandma, a mentor, somebody, then they're much more likely to follow through on a lot of those programs. If they don't have that support system or they don't have that support person, it's a lot more difficult for us.
Hmm. Well, in your shop, Chief Bleichner, do you guys still do the youth intervention program or intervention for youth?
Yes. Yeah, we do. We still have our youth intervention program, which is ran we have a licensed clinical social worker on staff. We utilize that person to provide a whole host of different services, and really, we will utilize it if at an early stages. We try and catch them early, from that 8, 9 on up to, you know, 17 years old. And it can be minor things before they tend to get involved with the criminal justice system. And a lot of it is they may be acting out at home or acting out at school and things like that. And so our hope is to get engaged through referrals. It's a voluntary program. It's not mandatory. We do have very good participation in that. And then we track also that youth to try and, if the family needs help or assistance, we kind of become that conduit to try and plug them into other resources within the community. But again, we try and provide that follow-up. And we're not truly a diversion program in a sense. We try and provide those services, but we do at times act in a way as a diversion program, because sometimes youth maybe do get in trouble for minor things. If we issue ordinance violations to the youth, all our juvenile ordinance violations go to our youth intervention specialist first. She screens those to see if those individuals are suitable for some outreach. She will reach out to them, and if those individuals want to enter into the program, they want to go through that program, then if they successfully complete it, then the ordinance violation is waived, and so it's an opportunity to give the youth another option in that situation, along with families, and provide some additional follow-up in those cases.
That's Normal Police Chief Rick Bleichner with GLT's Ryan Dunham. He was joined in studio by the new chair of the Juvenile Justice Council, Cassie Taylor, who's director of court services in McLean County.
The news you need when you want it. That's what you'll find at our website, WGLT.org. The latest local news stories, plus reports from Springfield, Washington, and around the world. You can also subscribe to our podcast and catch up on your favorite GLT features, from GLT's Grow to John Norton's music interviews and everything in between. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a look beyond the 2020 election to 2022. Right here on 89.1 and WGLT.org. Lawmakers did a lot during the spring session of the General Assembly. Budget, tax structure, gambling, minimum wage, even recreational marijuana. The pension problem, not so much. But State Senator Jason Berrickman of Bloomington says the pension issue is surfacing now, with talk of combining municipal fire and police pensions into one.
Well, I think it's a long way from soup, but I think what you're seeing is an interest on both sides of the aisle to a solution here, or this being a solution that both sides of the aisle can conceptually see as being a good one. I think the idea of consolidating the pension funds has been, it's been discussed generally for several years now. What's significant is you've got the governor signaling some level of support. He's a Democrat. You've got, in the Illinois House, Representative Mark Batnick, I think, is one of the Republican leaders on pension reform, and he's signaling support. So I think those are good signs for something happening here. Devil's in the details, of course, right? Mm-hmm. There's a reason why all those pension funds exist, and it's not all a negative reason.
Two words, local control.
Local control. And so I think, you know, the table is being set for a thoughtful conversation, negotiation on how we might be able to do it. But I think it's still a long ways ahead to come to an agreement.
What would it take for you to support that?
I come at this from the perspective of letting math and data help drive the decision.
Well, a bigger pot of money includes a better chance for bigger returns and more funding adequacy. So that's
sure.
The math.
So that's the theory.
That's the math part of it.
Yeah. Well, I would say, and that's where I'd say, Charlie, that's the theory. I'd like to see that. I like when we talk about the pension systems. My first response is, what do the actuaries say? Not what a politician thinks. Bigger and better means more efficient and more access and things. Those are concepts. I want to know, what does an actuary say? How could we fold these in together? And how could we make sure the oversight is free from the negative political games that can be played? And how do we ensure, of all those systems, you have some municipalities who've done a better job than others of meeting their obligations? Does that create a system of winners and losers when you fold the thing in together, where you're suddenly rewarding those who've been less financially responsibility at the penalty to those who have been?
There are differences in benefit packages, too, between the various municipalities and local government units.
That have been negotiated. That's mm-hmm. right. In those negotiations, again, if leaders locally have made good decisions in their negotiations and have made financially prudent decisions on what to do with their dollars, we've got to be conscious that what we're talking about doing could, in fact, penalize them, and we don't want to do that.
This doesn't, of course, address the other piece of the pension thing, the state workers and the five other pension systems that are dramatically underfunded. Is there attention starting to be paid to that now that apparently lawmakers have a working relationship established on budgets?
It's the I think it's been the elephant in the room all spring, and it's unfortunately gone without any significant discussions. You know, the governor never made any promises on his campaign that he was going to fundamentally reform those five pension systems, that he was going to attack the unfunded liability in any meaningful way. He kind of just he put other priorities in place. So here we are, as much of, you know, so many significant things happened this spring, but pensions in any manner wasn't one of them. I completely believe that the state has to become realistic. There's a twofold problem here. You know, and many of your listeners know the manner in which the pension systems exist and the fact that there's tiers, tier one, tier two. The tier one system has the massive unfunded liability associated with it. The tier two system, even talked about less, the tier two system, which offers significantly less generous benefits to state employees, is actually so, we're told, is such a poor retirement system that it may violate federal law, and if it violates federal law, it creates a new liability for the state. The state would have to contribute to the Social Security system. We don't do that for our...
For the Tier 1 folks.
That's right. So these things weigh on our balance sheet. I think that business leaders who look to the state as a place to potentially locate look at our balance sheet and say something is going to have to give in that state. And it creates a lack of predictability that discourages job creators from coming here. The reality is, you know, to the general public, the fact that this balance sheet debt is sitting out there doesn't necessarily hit them every day. that what hits them is what's the state's contribution this year and how do we fund it and does that mean we need to raise taxes or cut benefits from something else? That's the part the public really wrestles with. What I'm suggesting is we all need to understand the negative side of that balance sheet problem and how it negatively impacts our state and the need for the legislature to address that in a meaningful way here. I think it should be on the top of the list of things we need to do. There's a couple of things on the top of the list, but should be one of them.
Is it rising in the discussion now that the spring session is over?
It hasn't risen yet. I think the discussion about consolidating the municipal funds is really the first meaningful discussion that's starting on pensions generally. But I have not yet seen any significant interest in addressing the five state systems.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker in one of our periodic visits with State Senator Jason Berrickman of Bloomington Normal. We're still waiting on a lot of information to trickle out from various agencies about what the budget will actually do for local institutions. What is your sense of the capital bill and the projects on the list for Bloomington Normal, McLean County, and Central Illinois?
Yeah, I think all three. I think throughout Central Illinois, we're going to be a big winner from the capital bill. It's not that it's not controversial in how we got there, but the reality is, as I look throughout Central Illinois, whether it's our roads and bridges, whether it's the deferred maintenance and the capital needs that exist at some of our institutions like ISU in our backyard, there are a significant number of projects that are in need and are going to see real dollars from the capital bill. When you just look, I mean, you consider this, Charlie, the legislative district that I represent includes, six counties. It's half the state. It's from Eureka to Indiana, plus a big chunk of Bloomington Normal here. All of those roads, bridges, buildings, state parks, the correctional center that I represent up in Pontiac, mm-hmm. that has been under federal scrutiny for not accommodating the mentally ill that they're housing there. There are so many needs for capital that have gone unmet because we haven't had a capital program in a decade. I think Central Illinois is a big winner. You look at a legislative district in Chicago is the converse of this. The size of a district in Chicago is a mere fraction of the size of a district like I represent. I've got, over six counties. You've got legislators in the city of Chicago who can literally walk their district. They're not those capital dollars, though they will go into the city of Chicago, I don't think individual legislators in the city of Chicago are going to see the benefit individual legislators like us in Central Illinois are going to see in our districts. I think the capital bill is a big win for downstate and for Central Illinois.
So we know about the fine arts complex at ISU, and we know about potentially some money for Milner Library at ISU. What other projects do you think are specific big wins?
Well, the roads first and foremost, and that, look, we drive around town and, the city leaders are, I think, taking a lot of heat for the gigantic potholes that exist just throughout town, right? With the controversial issue here is the increase in the motor fuel tax, right? It's going up 19 cents. The dollars generated...
Plus inflationary after that.
That's right. Yeah, 19 cents out of the gate. The dollars generated from that component goes specifically to transportation, roads, very specifically. Your municipalities and township governments around the state are going to see the dollars that they get from this increase substantially.
60% or so.
Yeah.
I mean, for instance, McLean County government will see an extra $1.2 million in their formula-based motor fuel tax allocation from the state. So they're getting about $2 million now.
Yeah, so consider, when you consider what's out there in needs and where those dollars go, I think
their needs are $22 million in deferred maintenance so far. So it's not going to do the whole thing.
Right, and I don't think government ever is going to be able to say, hey, we got, you know, the needs addressed at 100%. I think the needs are always going to be out there. That's the nature of the beast. But I think everyone agreed that some significant move needed to be made on capital, and this is a significant move.
Republicans have typically opposed cost of living increases for things like minimum wage. How do you feel about cost of living or inflationary increases for the capital side of things? Is that merited in this case?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's merited. The offset here, and where everyone, you know, in politics gets themselves where everyone in politics gets themselves in trouble is if you put the government on auto spending, it doesn't allow, in our example, the legislature to control it and provide oversight. But I look at our state's infrastructure program. I look at how difficult it is to pass legislation like this, and I think it's an area where the right decision was made here.
Bloomington State Senator Jason Berrickman joined us, as he does about once a month here, on Bloomington Normal's only locally owned and operated broadcast media outlet. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The 2020 election is up next, but both parties are looking beyond that to 2022. That's the take from the Illinois Politics Roundtable. Sean Crawford moderates the panel with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, IPR Statehouse editor Brian Mackey, and Jerry Nowicki of Capital News Illinois. Nowicki says the governor signed an executive order recently regarding the census.
So they want to ensure an accurate count, and they have put in $29 million from the budget this year. And what's at stake is up to two congressional seats, the governor said, and as his Lieutenant Governor Stratton said, we could lose about $120 million a year for every 1% that is undercounted. So they really want to make sure everybody's getting counted in that census.
And what are some of the concerns with undercounting the census? I mean, are they fearful that that's going to happen? I know there's always some adjustments made to the census every time it's done, but is there something that's more concerning to them this year?
I don't know if it's more concerning this year, but with the out-migration, you know, we've been seeing for a while, there's a likelihood that we're going to lose at least one seat. But if they lost two congressional seats, that's a pretty big deal. And the citizenship question, which could appear on the census, Senator Aquino said that's just an intimidation tactic from the president to kind of edge out Latino communities, immigrant communities that should be counted in the census anyway, because the census counts residents, not citizens.
Charlie, Jerry mentioned some of the things that are at stake for the state of Illinois, and people may not realize that, but so much is dependent upon the census and the census being as accurate as possible when it comes to federal money, when it comes to congressional representation. Like you said, this is a big deal for the state.
Oh, yeah, it's a very big deal. And as a matter of fact, Jerry mentioned the challenge to the citizenship question. There is some evidence that at least some of President Trump's strategists, Republican strategists, thought that if we included a citizenship question on the census, which hasn't been there for more than 50 years, that this would be a deterrent for non-documented individuals, the so-called illegal aliens, to not step up to be counted, and that this therefore would depress the number of people, particularly in Hispanic communities, which tend to vote Democratic, and that this would be a plus for Republicans. And that question ultimately will be decided whether or not the Census Bureau can ask for a citizen or put in a citizenship question. Are you a citizen of the U.S.? That will ultimately be decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, probably before summer is out. And it's not just the representation in Congress, but if you think about it, the communities that tend to be hard to count, it's not suburban neighborhoods where everybody has a nice house and you can, and everybody has the internet and you can see pretty easily who's there. It tends to be inner cities, lower income people, people of color, people who are of a Hispanic background, and they tend to live in larger cities. They tend to be Democratic. And so the impact in Illinois would have an internal effect also if there's an undercount, because the state's 59 Senate and 118 House districts are apportioned according to population. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the last redistricting we had, based on the 2010 census numbers, the legislative district that had the most people only had one individual more than the district that had the fewest. That's how precise it is. And if there's an undercount, say, in communities of color in Chicago, that would dilute Chicago's legislative strength. It also would have an impact because there's a lot of money that the state doles out that's based on population. For example, for 50 years, ever since we've had an income tax, there's been a slice of the income tax that gets returned to cities and counties, and that's based on population. So if there's an undercount, for example, in Chicago, whereas maybe a town like Springfield or a town like Bloomington has a good count, that means some dollars that rightfully should be going to Chicago instead will be going to some downstate communities. So there's a lot more at stake than just congressional representation, although that is obviously probably the most significant factor in terms of the state.
And I can add just a personal experience here. I was a census taker back in 2000. Toward the end of my college education. I ended up landing a civil service job as a field operations supervisor for the 2000 census. One of the areas that our responsibility was Joliet. And there are some very economically depressed areas of Joliet where residents are pretty suspicious of coming to the door to talk to government officials, even friendly census takers. And so you already have challenges in getting people to respond to the census. But with the atmosphere that the president is stirring up with the citizenship question, as well as, you know, his vow to deport people, it certainly seems like it could make it that much more challenging to get people to respond.
One of the interesting things at the press conference yesterday was that Governor Pritzker had said, you know, we got to get people that are from these communities and that look like the people in these communities and have connections with people in these communities to go out and knock on those doors, mm-hmm. and to just make connections and meet one-on-one and build that type of trust with the people in those communities.
Yeah, and that certainly would have been helpful. I don't know how the federal government might have changed its hiring procedures. You know, there were tests. The tests were only at certain times. You couldn't really necessarily have outside groups, at least as I recall, again, this is almost 20 years ago now, coming with you on these door knockings. But, you know, it definitely helps to have people from the communities. The Census Bureau tried to do that, but there were just some areas where you got more people applying for jobs and other areas where people weren't. I mean, there is just a question of, do people even know these jobs are available in their areas? And so if this $29 million is put to that sort of outreach in advance, educating people, letting them know, hey, you can make pretty decent wages. It's only for a few months, but it's pretty good money for this type of work. And you can get some familiar faces from those neighborhoods, then that should improve participation.
Yeah, and there will be lots of grants to community organizations that are already well involved in this, and the governor said he wants to get that grant money out the door as soon as possible. So we'll see how that works out.
We'll continue to watch that issue over the next several months as Illinois gets ready for the census count. Let's move on to something that has already been signed into law, the Illinois state budget for the next fiscal year, which takes effect July 1st. Higher education got more money in this budget, something that the advocates for higher ed have been looking for a long time. And Brian, did they get as much as they wanted?
Well, it's never really as much as they wanted, is it? It is an increase, but higher ed has been one of the areas of the state budget that has, at least in terms of operating money, has been really, really diminished over the past couple of decades, not only in real terms, but particularly when adjusted for inflation. The higher ed, and I don't have the percentage off the top of my head, but it's significantly lower than what the state contributed. Now, there are critics who will say, well, a lot of that money has been crowded out because Illinois is contributing so much more to the state university retirement system, to university pensions, which, full disclosure, all of us on this panel except Jerry are members of the state university retirement system. But this is something where higher ed has been really losing a lot of state support. Because of that, tuition has been going up, and partially because of that, Illinois has seen a lot more students than used to choosing to go out of state for college and university.
Jerry, you've been covering this issue as well and writing about it. What stood out to you regarding higher education and the money in the state budget?
Well, I spoke to the Board of Higher Education, and they're actually really excited as well about the capital funding. I think there's $2 billion in new funding, and they're somewhere around $1 billion in funding that hadn't been appropriated from previous capital plans. So they're saying the new facilities, you know, and they see it'll just entice the students to stay in Illinois. Say, look at the state's now making this investment in education, and, you know, we might go to this school to see the new nursing facilities come to fruition and to be able to work in those and just other facilities like that. So there's a lot to be excited about, is what they told me at IBHE.
Jerry Nowicki of Capital News Illinois speaking on the Illinois Politics Roundtable from IPR with Brian Mackey, Charlie Wheeler, and panel moderator Sean Crawford. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. WGLT.org is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock and Ryan Denham. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.